Welcome to Changing Conversations with Billy Burke and me, Sarah Philp. This is a podcast creating space for conversations with, for and by educators. Conversation is one of the oldest ways to nurture the conditions for growth and improvement. When we talk about what matters, we come alive, and conversation has the power to guide us into new and different actions, offering the potential for great things. We bring you conversations that have resonance both now and in the future. With the help of guests and the odd solo episode, we explore leadership, learning and well-being. We have the conversations we know you want to listen to. In this episode, I chat with Andy Griffith and Margaret Pollock. Andy is the author of numerous books, including the co-author of Teaching Backwards, which I know many of you have and use, and most recently he has co-authored The Working Classroom. Margaret joins us from St Luke's High School in East Renfrewshire, and having worked with Andy recently, it was great to have her experience and perspective as part of the conversation. Andy, Margaret, it's lovely to see you both. Delighted to have both of you joining me here tonight. So let's jump straight into introductions. Andy, first of all, I guess we've known each other over the years, but not seen each other for a number of years. So for those listening, can you tell them just a little bit about yourself and who you are, what you do, where you're based as well?
Yeah, okay. Well, listeners can probably tell by my accent, I'm a northerner. Believe it or not, I've lived in the north of England since 1985, pretty much on and off. So I'm born in a place called Edmonton, North London. I still got my accent to a large extent, but I'm based in Liverpool now, actually. So I started teaching in 1989, and then I went self-employed in 2001, mostly working with students initially, a lot with excluded students, a lot with projects with Comic Relief. Then I started getting into teacher development stuff, teacher training stuff, and that's where we met Sarah when I was creating some courses that got scaled up and ended up running quite a lot in Scotland as well. But yeah, at the moment I pretty much work in four schools across the north of England. I have some odd training around that here and there, and all of those schools are very, very high pupil premium percentages, what in Scotland is the equivalent of the pupil equity fund.
Yeah,
so they're all over 50%. And I've been working in those schools for quite a long time now. And places such as Merseyside, Bradford, Lancashire. I love the work I do. So it's really nice because like the community has like let me into their school, really, if that makes sense. So I'm not a great believer in doing drive-by training. I like staying in a school and having a relationship for a longer period of time. So yeah, do teacher development stuff, and then I create training courses and run programs for the students as well.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you. And we'll come on to some of that in more detail in a minute. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us. It's always lovely to have practitioners and people based in schools join the conversations on our podcast as well. So I've given listeners a clue there, but perhaps you can tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do as well.
Okay, sure. Thank you so much, Sarah. And thank you, Andy, as well, for inviting me on. I've been a teacher since the year 2000. When I graduated, I've worked in St Luke's High School in Barrhead all that time. I'm a biology, chemistry, science teacher to trade. And then spent about 15 years as a PT pastoral care at St Luke's before moving on to my current post, which is as deputy head teacher since 2019. I think, you know, as Andy says, you know, the school that I work in is probably a school that's very similar to the school that I went to as a young person. You know, I really love the school that I work in. I love working with the young people, their families, and many of them have grown up. I've taught some of the mums now, dare I say. I do enjoy my job. I'm head of year for first year, so they certainly keep me busy. But, you know, I absolutely love teaching, and it's so nice to be able to work with such a wide array of different people. I feel very fortunate to do the job that I do.
So I guess you both have in common that you're both quite connected and integrated within the communities in which you're working for an extended period of time, which is interesting. Yeah. So Andy, tell us, I know it's a big question to begin with, but what is it you are called to do? Because I guess, having had conversations with you over the years, I get a sense that the work you're doing now and the work you've done through the book, which we'll come on and talk a little bit more about as well, is really what you probably feel you're called to do. And maybe I'm putting words in your mouth there, but I'm just interested in your perspective on that.
Yeah, I mean, you are putting words on. But yeah, I mean, called is a strong word. But yeah, I guess I feel most comfortable in settings, which bit like Margaret was saying, really. And I'm a, you know, council flat kid, free school meals kid. I was very, very fortunate that at the time when I went to school in the 70s and 80s, I think government policy that was residual policy from previous sort of Labour governments enabled people like me to go to university. I got a full grant, you know, housing benefit, bus pass, all of that stuff. And I've never forgotten how grateful I am, really, to people I've never really met who have set those systems up for me. So yeah, I went to university, got a good degree in economics from a Russell Group University, and I guess a lot of people probably would think, well, let's go into finance, let's go into the city banking or something like that. But I guess I've been drawn to working in I'd like to say, if it's not too arrogant, say in a socially useful job. I think it's I feel like I want to make a difference. When I've done work and I don't feel I'm making a difference, or I don't feel that I'm in harness with a partner that's got the same values as myself, I'm nowhere near as happy. So I've really enjoyed working with excellent leaders and excellent teachers in school turnaround in particular, especially when those schools are in socially disadvantaged areas. And by turning around the school, you don't just change the expectations, you materially change the attainment levels of more and more students. You improve their experiences, increase their enjoyment. And in England at the moment, there's huge challenges since the pandemic around attendance. I'm sure it's the same in Scotland, around engagement with pupils. So just being part of that challenge is something I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm. And from the work that you're doing now, or the work you've been doing in recent years, what do you feel is the difference you're making? You talked there about making a difference, and you know, many of us can resonate with that and connect with that, but for you, what is that difference?
So I work within the system. I'm not at a level where I'm influencing politicians. So I see myself as a trainer, really. So I create training courses that for both teachers and for students. So by and large, I hope the training courses are enjoyable and are meaningful for the people, and it leads to improvement, or it leads to changes in mindset. So on the teacher training side of things, if, say, for instance, I've worked in a school for 3 years and I work with staff with whole school inset, and I do interventions with teachers and I do coaching with teachers, I'd like to think that helps to improve the average lesson for the average experience in the school. So a lot of my work's about improving the default lesson in the school, mm-hmm. moving the bell curve of teaching quality to the right, if that makes sense. And then latterly, I guess, working with students, I've set up programs which, for instance, the Scholars Program is a program set up now with three different schools. I just believe that in some communities, because of disadvantage, some students need the extra and the different. So that's a program where, because those students are not from families that are going to have the money to pay for private tutors, I set up a program which does deliberately try to close that gap, if you like, mm-hmm. compared to a household that would have that home advantage. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I see myself as a trainer, Sarah, and so in quite an entrepreneurial way, not in a financially entrepreneurial way, I just say, give me a challenge and I'll create a training course and I'll deliver the training course and hopefully it'll be successful. Sometimes it's not initially successful, But I'm really determined as a person to create good training products. And of course, they're evaluated in different ways, qualitative and quantitative. But I think, you know, certainly in England, with the schools that I've helped to improve in relation to Ofsted levels, and the teachers who are getting better grades now for their students, and then students as well getting better grades and feeling just more aspirational about their future, mm-hmm. And more determined is measurable, and something I'm really proud of and hope to continue for many years to come.
Yeah, thank you. And Margaret, how does that how does Andy's kind of purpose connect and resonate for you as a school leader in the work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that just touching on what Andy said about investing in teachers, our school's done a lot of work using one of Andy's programs through our learning and teaching coach Judy Pitt. So we call it, well, it's the OTI program.
Yes.
We call it our Outstanding Teacher Initiative. Yes. And about half of our staff have been trained through that, and some have achieved GTC accreditation. And I think as a school, we recognise that time and investment in pedagogy, and really taking time for teachers to take stock and to look at the different learning and teaching approaches, and really engaging young people in their learning. We recognise the importance of that, because especially after COVID, that engagement of young people, and we found that to really make a difference, when you talk to young people about what do you think a good learner is, and they would come and say somebody who wears their uniform and somebody who is on time for school and does their homework. But in actual fact, it's more about, we're trying to build our young people up to be what we're calling assessment capable. So, where they are confident in their learning, they know where they are, they're confident to be able to find out the next steps in their learning. And it's only when you get that true engagement in the classroom that's when, well, I believe that you're going to really be able to close that gap for young people. So our school has done a lot of work using Andy's OTI program, and Andy also very kindly came and spoke to our staff and did a bit of work with our staff back in May at our learning and teaching conference. And he also worked with some of our teachers and young people as part of his scholars program that he was talking about. So yeah, I think that as a teacher, first and foremost, it's really important to teachers that you have got that engagement in the classroom. You want young people to do well, and how good does it feel when you get that penny drop moment? There's still nothing beats it in the classroom when you hear them going, ah, all right, I see. Just absolutely love it. It's why we do what we do. And I think it's amazing that the work that Andy has done and really recognised that, to get in amongst doing that teacher training is so valuable for schools. And certainly my school have really benefited from that.
Yeah. And I guess what I'm hearing as well is that your school has really benefited from the investment the school has made in the school and the staff.
Yeah,
that's not easy to do. Actually, I think we all recognise that, but you've obviously made a significant investment in many ways there.
Yeah, I think we felt our new head teacher, Christine Downey, started in 2016, and the school was in a good place then, but sometimes it takes for new people to come in with fresh eyes at things, and the school have really been on a journey then, and we've heavily invested in pedagogy, and at the beginning staff undertook professional inquiries, and at that time, although professional inquiry is more common now, at that time back in 2016-2017 wasn't really heard of. So we felt that it was important that we invested time in taking staff with us, rather than there's nothing worse than people feeling like things are being done unto them. And so I think Andy does that really well, and so does his program, the OTI program. But just that real investment in teacher pedagogy, and allowing teachers that time and space away from the classroom to get together with other practitioners, it's so important, and it's actually been really beneficial to get us to where we are today, which is in a really great position, I think.
Yeah.
So important.
It really is, and it's part of that being valued and being trusted as a profession as well, I think. Yeah.
I think young people get that from their teachers as well. You know, young people will be the first to recognise if a teacher's invested in them, be the first to, you know, critique your lesson and give you that feedback. And sometimes, you know, it's hard to take, or you'll go away and think that lesson was awful. Or it's really good when actually they say, I really enjoyed that, or I loved that lesson today. So I think getting that, you know, that's really important to teachers as well. And so giving them the time and space to go away and work with people like Judy and using the OTI programme, you know, when people feel really valued, that's when you're going to get the best out of them. But I think it's the same for young people as well. You know, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to, you know, enable young people, empower them to see that, you know, they can lead their own learning, that they can be confident, be engaged in their learning, and then they can start to reap the benefits of that. That's really what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can tell you're invested and passionate about your school and the impact you're having as well.
I am.
Which is a good thing. That's definitely a compliment. So Andy, you've just recently released another book, and this one I think takes a slightly different perspective or a different lens, and it's titled The Working Classroom. And I'm going to start with the title. I'm curious about the title. I'm curious about the intentional choice of words there. Help us understand that a little bit.
Yeah, my eldest son is a script editor, and he came up with the title. He's very good at that type of thing. He was. I'll give him a plug now, because he was script editor on Jimmy McGovern's latest drama, Time. You know, so if listeners haven't listened to it yet, watch it. It's on the iPlayer. But yeah, obviously he's been working with Jimmy McGovern and some other really talented writers. The book is really about working class students and their families. I think it, in Margaret will know, you know, when I try to use humor quite a lot, and but it's not really, unfortunately, it's not really a place for that. I mean, the book's really written out of anger, Sarah, in a way, because I think that the working class get a really bad deal in education. People like Margaret and thousands of others do their best to make try to mitigate some of those systemic challenges, if you like, you know, assessment systems and just general prejudice that's out there, I guess, in society. So so the book really is about working class underachievement, how working class maybe are underrepresented and undervalued. So we start off by defining the working class, which we use a common sociological definition of people in social classes C2, D and E. And that's about 50% of the population in the UK. Interestingly, 60% of people in the UK claim to be working class. So there's a somewhat affective element to class, because a lot of people identify with being working class and proud of being working class. And yet a lot of what education seems to be about is trying to get kids to be more middle class. And again, if your listeners haven't heard, haven't watched Amal Rajan's BBC programme, How to Crack the Class Ceiling, that's a two-part documentary on the iPlayer. I don't know if you've seen it, Margaret, but it's a really, really interesting programme. In fact, you would have seen it, because we talked about that when I came up to St. Luke's. Yeah, and it's in a way it's about four young people who could be in any school in the UK, but they're from working class backgrounds and they're trying to break into non-traditional working class jobs. And it's really, really interesting. I won't spoil it for people, but I think what the programme comes to as a conclusion over the two episodes of the 2 hours, Sarah, is, do we try and change the system, or do we posh wash our kids? Do we teach them to be more middle class so they fit in with the system? So it's an interesting dilemma that Amal Rajan poses, and I guess we have to be very careful with the way that we teach certain things. One of the things being oracy, so oracy, which I predict will will have a greater emphasis should Labour get elected the next election, mm-hmm. Within curriculum. I mean, it may not happen in Scotland because there's obviously different systems. But there's a real danger, I think, that a lot of working class kids could really, really be switched off by this. But equally, I'm sure, Margaret, you'd agree, there's ways of teaching this that are really, really interesting and dynamic. And just teaching children about code switching when it's appropriate, but not feeling that they should be at all ashamed of their working class culture or their working class roots. So what's your take on it, Margaret? What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the work that Andy, you did with our staff on Odyssey was something that we are really keen to be taking forward. It's taking a bit of a backseat at the minute because I've just had my HMI, but certainly, yeah, I totally agree. And I think we're already looking at, asking teachers to have a think about, what does that look like in their classroom, and, teaching young people how they can switch between, the skills that they're learning in one subject, can they transfer that across? That real importance of recognising when, they're using language in English or, modern languages, but then switching to science or maths and really, upskilling them so that they are confident and don't feel like they just sit in sort of the boxes. A lot of times young people, I think they don't quite appreciate the skills that they're learning across the curriculum. That they can transfer across. So we are certainly taking that work forward, Andy, that you did with our small group of staff to look at Odyssey and how we can then really incorporate that into the work that we've already done around learning and teaching and building that engagement of young people, but building that confidence in young people so that they don't shy away from things and they've not got barriers because, they don't understand the context of a question. And when you were working with our staff as well, Andy, and you mentioned in the book about the cultural capital of young people, so again, that was something that resonated with us. Yeah. And you don't want it to be a barrier, and you're trying to make sure that your curriculum and your experiences that you're giving young people, that you're giving them as wide an experience as possible within the confines of, the day to day.
But interestingly, Margaret, I mean, in England, schools are now inspected by Ofsted on their provision of cultural capital. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we did when I worked with your staff, one of the things we talked about is all different types of capital, didn't we? Which is, social capital, educational capital. And generally, working class people have less of all of those things. They also have less economic capital, which means they've got less money to spend on things like private tutors, and their parents have got less connections, or they've got less social capital. So I think what's really interesting, Sarah, is that what the book tries to do is to give some practical solutions now to teachers teaching working class students about what they can do to raise those capitals, so that those students are less disadvantaged by, for instance, their lack of connections, their lack of money. And of course, it can't make up for some of the issues, mm-hmm. but I think it's quite an interesting debate to have because, and again, Margaret, jump in any time here, or you, Sarah, but there's been a lot of play in schools around mindset for maybe last 10, 15 years, and I'm okay with that, but what Pierre Bourdieu talks about is this word habitus, and I think that's a much more interesting concept. Habitus is about understanding growing one's comfort zone. Now, in a way, that's similar to mindset, but it also is an understanding of why you might feel like that as well. And if you're living in a damp flat, or you've got you see your parents working three shifts just to sort of just about get by, that it's hard to have a growth mindset in that context. Mm-hmm. So I actually think that studying things like cultural capital, social capital, studying habitus, studying some of those sociological terms, it should be something that I think all staff get involved in, because it does give you greater empathy and understanding. And if I can just say one thing before I hand over, you'll see at the moment in on the BBC, the COVID inquiry and some of the interviews that are taking place. Well, what's absolutely obvious is that there was, I mean, one of the former government's advisors talked about this, is that some, he sat around a table once and there was 20 odd people around the table, civil servants, politicians, and not one of them was a free school meals background. And I do think that at all levels of society, but particularly the senior levels, there is a lack of understanding about people who perhaps are most struggling in our society. And there's also a myth around this that you deserve what you get, you know, at both ends. There's the myth of meritocracy, which some people think that, well, if they've done well, then it must all be down to me. And there's also the myth that a lot of people that are struggling, that have got issues with poverty and that type of thing, have brought it on themselves. And I do feel that, you know, both of those things need to be... And schools, by and large, do a fantastic job about that. But our book is really trying to get rid of two types of classism within schools. Downward classism, where you've got people looking down on people from lower social classes and mm-hmm. seeing that there's something wrong with them that needs fixing. And then the other one is an internalized classism. And Margaret, I'm sure you see it with students. I see it with students all the time who say, well, I can't do something like that because, you know, I'm from this estate, or I can't be that because... And we're trying to challenge both of those forms of discrimination. So one of them is a mental one. And I guess, Sarah, that's far more significant to me than mindset, which is almost like saying, you know, regardless of your economic circumstances or lack of connections, you can do just as well as someone else. And I just don't think that's true, you know.
No, I think as well, Andy, you know, the school that I work in, where as one of our, like part of our vision, values and aims is no poverty of aspiration for young people, and, you know, really trying to upskill them to say, you know, you can absolutely do anything that you want to do, but it's getting that self-belief. And again, I think that's where the curriculum is so important, as well as the teachers that are there in the school, having that real understanding of the young people who are in front of you. You're right, I remember when I first started in the school, the head teacher at the time told me something really important, and I've always sort of passed it on. You know, do you know much about the area that the school's in Barrhead in the west of Scotland? Go and take a drive around and about, because you'll see the real differences in the demographic of the area, and that's really important to have an understanding of where the young people in the school are coming from, because in some areas of my school, you'll have young people in the most affluent areas, but then you'll have young people who are experiencing, you know, real poverty every day. So it's really important, I think, that we do have an understanding, but that we as educators, you know, really make sure that young people don't feel that that's a barrier to them. And you're right, it is a mindset, but I absolutely think that, you know, that's sort of why, well, I certainly do what I do. And I think that, you know, everybody wants the best for their own child. That's why it's really important to work so much with the community and with parents, just to make sure that everybody, you know, is coming with you.
I agree completely there. And quite a few of the things we talk about in the book aren't just things that we hypothesize would be good. It's things we've actually done, and including examples in your school. You know, I love the atmosphere of St. Luke's as well. I really, really do. So as one practical example, one of the things that a lot of the students will struggle with is lack of social capital. So for instance, if you've got a student who wants to study law, by the way, the statistics on this are quite frightening. You're 17 times more likely to go into law if your parents are in the legal profession. So if your parents aren't in that, you're already at a disadvantage in terms of lack of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So things like doing the mock trial competition, which has been going for years in England, things like having Zoom conversations with barristers. Now, that's something that's really interesting. The scholars programs that I've built don't just happen in school time, but there's experiences such as trips, There's extracurricular provision, but there's also a research element to it. So students will have Zoom conversations with people and begin a relationship with people who often come about through a connection to a connection. Mm-hmm. So we've had students, we've gone to staff in all three of the schools and said, look, do you know a barrister? Do you know a chief engineer? Do you know a... And we had an amazing situation just last year, Sarah, where one of my students, Erin, and you ask students what they want to do. And she was very, very clear. I want to do makeup in films. I want to do film makeup. I want to do prosthetics, all that type of stuff. Wow. Okay. So we put out some feelers, and I've got a mate who's a painter and decorator, whose mate he used to work in the film industry, whose brother still does. And he's done the makeup for David Bowie in Labyrinth. He's worked with Jim Henson. And this guy has had multiple Zoom conversations with this girl. He's got a work placement. You know, so this is massive, because this isn't a connection through her family. It's a connection through the determination that the team of the school's got to try to be that family for her, you know. So in that respect, we've got a student who is on a pathway now, mm-hmm. not just dreaming of something, because a mm-hmm. lot of students don't know where to start, you know. So those are a few practical things that we do. And it does involve some you know, evenings being given up by some teachers, doing what we're doing now, you know, maybe an hour Zoom call to make some introductions, and the parents will be on and that sort of thing. And actually, what's really interesting, and I don't know if you guys can jump in on this, but you know, when you meet people outside of education, a lot of them are only too pleased to help, but they just, you've got to find a way of asking them, you know. So I'm very cheeky about that. That's going back to being entrepreneurial again. I look, you know, can you speak to one of my students 6 o'clock one night? And actually what that's done is snowballed from maybe 3 or 4 Zooms a year to about, I think, 25 Zooms that we currently got on the schedule. Yeah. This year. And that's no small thing, because what will happen is that a student will come back into school and be absolutely buzzing. And a bit of language that we talk about in the book, they've been sparked. There's been some sparking that's taken place. And sparking can also take place, because I know, Margaret, you take your students to university visits, don't you? Sparking can take place in extracurricular clubs. It can take place when a visiting speaker comes into the school, especially if that speaker looks and sounds like them as well. They're from a working class background.
Yeah.
And they can see that that's therefore a pathway.
And something that certainly, you know, with COVID and the lockdown, obviously, technology was wonderful at the time, because as we all started to return, you know, we still had young people that we were trying to prepare for leaving school for, you know, the world of work or college or university, who weren't then getting the opportunities that we would normally have with the big careers event and the partners being able to come in. So in some respects, we had to be really creative with that. But then it's about, you know, maintaining those contacts and still keeping things like that going, the Zoom conversations, or beaming people in so that they can talk to groups of students. I think as well, what's been really good for us is we've recognised the importance of, as young people who have been at the school have gone on and, you know, have had successes in whatever their career pathway is, to really invite them back in. So
yeah, absolutely. That graduate thing is absolutely massive, and uh-huh. I'm using graduate in the widest possible sense. So we had something recently, Margaret, where one of the schools I work at, which is in Kirby, in Merseyside, we recognise that there's about 15 to 20 students in what you would probably call year 4, we call year 10, who, best will in the world, are not going to do the full suite of GCSEs, and they're going to get ones and twos in a few of those GCSEs. So we've got them on apprenticeship pathways. Mm-hmm. So we took them on a visit to a couple of workplaces, and while they was at these workplaces, deliberately, and again, Sarah, that's something we talk about in the book, deliberate and specific interventions. Mm-hmm. Deliberately, we got that workplace to send us down their apprentices who had come from our school the year before. and they sat and had a cup of tea with them, and they can see it's not a definite apprenticeship, it's not a promise, but it's very, very strongly intimated that, well, this can be your pathway. So, you know, this school is now building a skill center, which is alongside the school, and they're recognizing that, you know, that one size fits all curriculum just doesn't work for a lot of students. And one of the things, again, that everybody should be interested in who's listening to this, regardless of their social class, because no class is an island, is that we have got over 10% of our young population who are currently not in employment and training. That's 720,000-odd young people. That is just such a waste of talent and resource. So anything we can do to spark, to get students on the right pathway, not to squeeze them through some sort of, you know, middle class curriculum or assessment regime that doesn't fit them, we should all be embracing.
Yeah, I think as well, when I talked about us starting out on that journey back in 2016, 2017, as well as looking at our pedagogy, we also then started what we called our big curriculum debate. And we went to the staff, but we went to pupils and parents, and we said to them, you know, what do you think of the curriculum as is? What do you think the jobs of the future are going to be? What are you worried about? And it was really interesting what came back, especially from young people. You know, they were talking about, they were worried about, was there going to be a job for them when they left school? They talked about, they were worried about war, disease. I think Ebola was at that point quite prevalent. They talked about climate change. And, you know, following on from that and also listening to what employers were telling us and what universities were saying, you know, we need young people who are going to be able to come with the skills and the confidence that they're going to need for us to help them, you know, become the workforce of the future. And that's been a journey that we've been on as well. And we've really, you know, been quite brave, I would say, and that we've really started to redesign our curriculum, especially for our broad general education, S1, 2 and 3. So every faculty has started to look at moving away from the traditional topic by topic. So I'm a science teacher, so you used to do your chemistry topic, your biology topic, your physics topic. And, you know, it wasn't really working, it wasn't sparking young people like Andy's talking about. So about 2 years ago, the science team, and it was similar across the different faculties, but we got together and we've really revamped our curriculum. So now the young people come in and we're doing The Martian. Might have been based on a really famous film with, you know, a certain actor who you know, it's quite easy on the eye, but it's so exciting because the young people come in and like, we're doing The Martian, but it does interconnect all the aspects of the curriculum that they need to know about, but it also gives us the opportunity as teachers to bring in, you know, things about AI and like exploring the planets. And yeah, can you really?
But Margaret, you're being too modest, because you won a creativity award, didn't you, for your curriculum design too?
We were finalists. Yes, we were. Yeah. We were finalists. Thank you, Andy. We were down to the last three in June. So yes, for Education Scotland. But yes,
you were robbed. You should have won it, I think. But there you go.
I do think that's so important. What you're saying, you need to find the spark for young people. Yeah. And again, that's something that you know, that's your why, I suppose, isn't it?
It comes back to also what you said earlier, Margaret, isn't it? That, you know, feedback is so important. And I mean, my first year, I'll never forget my first, if you call it term of teaching, 1989, I just asked some of my students, you know, has my teaching been, you know, I've got quite a few satisfactories, you know, but but yeah, you know, you're starting out on your profession, you're starting out to. But it's important to ask, isn't it? It's the easiest thing in the world, really. But many teachers almost resist the easiest thing in the world. Just get them to rate your lesson, and okay, sometimes there's short term unpopularity. But I think if you explain to students that learning is about challenge, it is about going through cognitive and emotional challenges to get to a different feeling, and like you say, get that eureka moment. It's a fantastic feeling. And you want your students to have as many of them as possible, definitely, yeah.
I think a lot of what comes out, Andy, when staff have done the OTI programme and when we've looked at it as part of our work in visible learning, you know, that feedback is really important. And what does it actually look like? And lots of the staff that have participated in OTI, they talk about, you know, when they get filmed, And then they get given the film and they watch it back, just themselves. Yeah. But then they meet the next day to talk about it. And, you know, I think that's quite powerful as well. It's quite a difficult thing to do, but it is so important. You're so right.
Yeah.
So picking up that theme of feedback, Andy, what would be the feedback you would like to get from teachers when they read your book? What is it you want it to do?
So I think there's a couple of things, really. I guess I think we define success very narrowly in education and in society too. I can't remember the last time I met you, Sarah, but it was, I don't think I was in a very good place, in all honesty. I didn't feel full that my sort of success, if you like, didn't feel that happy. I'm much, much happier now as a person, because I think I've got my metrics spot on. You know, I've got a good balance in my life between family, friends, and doing something which I think is socially useful. I always need that in my life. So I'd like people to read the book and think, right, okay, I'll try that idea out. And there are many, many ideas in the book. For instance, improving the quality of reading interventions, improving the quality of literacy is a massive thing you can do. And I think it really can be game-changing. I mean, if you can get more young people embracing the love of reading, or as you say, Margaret, the love of film, there's so much that can come out of some of that media. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is, I as a young teacher, I wasn't a big one on asking permission. I just did stuff, which is probably why the reason I'm self-employed. So if you want to run an extracurricular club, if you want to bring something, you'd be an absolute mad if you was a head teacher and you said no to that enthusiasm.
Yeah.
There's also, I think, a discussion to be had around do working class students see themselves in the curriculum? So when I went to school in London in the 70s and 80s, it was just emerging. You would get more female writers, more black writers. There was no themes around sexuality, no gay writers, but that's changed now. And it's been brilliant that you've got a much more diverse, if you like, set of resources for students and examples for students. But I think class has often been neglected. Mm-hmm. And because it's not protected under law, because it's not a protected characteristic, I think sometimes class is overlooked. And although this, I want to be really clear about this, although there's still evidence of racism in society, still lots of issues to do with, you know, sexism and other forms of discrimination, there's been a lot of progress in those areas where there hasn't been as much progress, I think, with people from a working class background, especially those who within the working class are actually materially poor as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's partly about raising awareness, partly about changing teachers' metrics of what you measure as success. I do think, though, Sarah, more teachers should challenge the system.
Mm-hmm.
You can challenge it in different ways, because I think that if you're a teacher and you honestly think that the system is right, that almost everything culminates in an exam in silence in a hall at the end of all that time, you've got to be seriously wrong there. I'm sorry, but I really do think that some assessment needs to be done that way.
Yeah.
But that's a university model. That's a model that's, you know, let's show that you can do written exams so you can go to university. I feel there are too many young people coming out of our system who are looking back and have not enjoyed their education or found it useful. So I guess there's there is a little bit of that within the book. Try and challenge the existing system, but control what you can control.
Mm-hmm.
If you're into this type of issue that Margaret and I are, which is to do with putting your energy into a community, then put your energy in. Run some after-school clubs. Offer to run some interventions, some programs that will stretch and enable more students to have more advantage. So yeah, I guess that's a key part of it, that it gives them some practical examples to make more of a difference more of the time.
Yeah. And Margaret, I can see how you spark off Andy, and I can see the relationship and the connection. But how has his work and your connection with him either kind of endorsed the work you do or challenged and extended the work you do? And you've touched on some of that already, but just curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what Andy does or talks about in the book really chimes with, you know, where we are as a school and, you know, things that Andy's talked about just try something new in our school. You know, we're really open to teachers bringing new ideas or things that they've seen or if they've read about something, I'd like to try it. Start small, you know, in our school as well. We try to really develop maybe bespoke interventions as well for groups of young people rather than trying to, you know, try something on mass for a year group. You know, invest the time, try and identify, look at your information that you've got, get to know the young people and really try things out and then see, you know, has that worked? It's important to, you know, track it, if you like, measure it. What was the impact? Get the feedback from the young people and then see, is it something that we want to scale up? Or do we think, you know what, we tried it out, it's not really for us, let's look at something else. And I think that's where Andy's book does give lots and lots of different examples that schools can try to suit their context as well, because I think that's something that's got to be really important.
I think you're right. I mean, I think interventions, I mean, if I could give a plug to my daughter, Anna. My daughter, Anna, runs a community interest company called Dramatic Recovery. So they do drama interventions for mental health. And, you know, they've got contracts in different schools in England. But it's a short, intensive program, maybe over 6 weeks. As you say, Margaret, with young people that have been identified as having an issue. But even if a small percentage of that, even if one student suddenly is turned around by that intervention, switched back on, I go back to that language of sparking. If it can spark them, reconnect them, their attendance goes up, their engagement goes up, and their whole association with education goes up. Yeah. And so I think that's really interesting. Equally, behaviour interventions, mm-hmm. You know, you have to evaluate it, and that's why it's always good to start small.
Yeah.
But if you've got a program from an outside organisation or a member of staff within the school or the community that can come in and it seems to be working, let's just keep doing it because it can change a young person's life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Thank you both. You barely needed me there. Facilitating the conversation yourselves. But what I think you've given us, not just insights into the book, which is always interesting and always useful, but the connection with you, Margaret, has helped kind of locate and embed that in the Scottish context as well. And brilliant just to hear the two of you bouncing ideas and sharing reflections and experiences together. So thank you both for your time at a busy time of year. We're recording this just before Christmas, so I know it's a busy time for both of you. But before you go, we finish our podcast with the same two questions every time, so I'll ask you both the same questions. First question is, what are you reading at the moment? And can I come to you first, Margaret?
So, probably changes with what I was talking about. I'm reading at the minute Putting Faces on the Data. It's Lynn Sharrett and Michael Fullan, just because, you know, the things that I've been talking about, we've got a wealth of data in school that looks like, you know, year groups and attainment data. But what we find in our school is, you know, that's not enough because our young people are so complex that we need to really get down to look at each individual person and make sure that whatever we are designing fits them and it's going to benefit them. So,
and such a powerful statement as well, or tag, you know, putting faces on data, because I think that can really shift.
Yeah.
Science and how we think and how we feel and how we connect with that data as well. Andy, how about you? What are you reading at the moment?
So it's a guy we quote a lot in our book, but he's got a new book out. It's Professor Danny Dorling has written a book called Shattered Nation. And the book talks about the five new social evils that that exist in the UK. He builds on the discussion of the Beveridge report after the war, and every political party after the war wanted to get rid of those five social evils that Beveridge identified, which were idleness, squalor, disease, ignorance, and want. And I think what Danny Dorling is writing about, and he's a geographer, really, really great guy. You'll see some of his lectures on YouTube as well, but he's talking about things that really resonate with us: elitism, prejudice, despair, waste, and exclusion. And there's a chapter on each of them. And in some respects, Sarah, it's a bit of a depressing read because like James O'Brien's latest book, we are in, as a nation, in a pretty bad place at the moment. But there's hope. And I think, you know, what gives me hope is the quality of the people that I've met in education who could easily do lots of other things, but they choose to stay within that sector. And then also the young people I come across on a daily basis, and that gives me massive hope. And I just hope that some of these people grab the reins of power and let people like, you know, Danny Dorling have a big influence on policy going forward, because it'd be a lot easier to swim with the tide of change mm-hmm. rather than against it, because it's very hard sometimes. I'm sure you'd agree, Margaret, a lot of schools just massively under-resourced financially in terms of people as well. So we'd certainly both be lobbying for more resource. But we'd want, and we're absolutely comfortable with, you know, with that being measured. But yeah, I really recommend Professor Danny Dorling's work, but Shattered Nations, what I'm reading, Margaret, at the moment, Sarah.
Yeah, well, I'm glad there's hope in it as well. Because
absolutely, there has to be. There has to be. Yeah.
And just to finish off, is there a quote or a message that you would like to leave listeners with? And again, I'll come to you first, Margaret.
To all teachers, you know, I always think teachers are amazing, and really thankful that that's the profession that I'm in. And just, it's, you know, teaching young people is why we do what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Margaret. And how about you, Andy?
I echo what Margaret said. Although I've been self-employed a long time, I've always worked pretty much within education as an industry. And I haven't regretted it at all. I do think that my message would be that don't just look at the metrics of happiness or success to do with what you own. Mm. I think the people that are happier in life is people that give more than they get. Mm. And certainly... what's great about working in education is you meet a lot of people who every single day they're thinking about somebody else, how they can help them to live a better life. So it's a very, very healthy place to work in the mental health sense. So I'd recommend teaching as a profession 100%.
Me too.
Yeah. And there's ups and downs, but I think the amount of people you can help with doing that job is immense, and that's what I love about it so much.
Yeah, it's just getting that penny drop moment, isn't it? That's what it's about.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah,
and I have no doubt that tonight in this conversation you have both sparked enthusiasm and ideas and given a bit of hope as well to others, and given ideas about what people can do and be brave about doing as well. So a massive thank you. Thank you for your time, and thank you for sharing your insights and your wisdom with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it and found it useful. If you enjoy listening, you can support us by following on your preferred platform, sharing on social media, or leave us a review. Thanks again.